Hey, it's Don Coscarelli, filmmaker. I just wrote a book. Check it out. It's called Fiction, Tales from the World of Phantasm. And it can teach you all the things that you never knew about the Phantasm film series. A lot of interesting stuff. Horror, violence, not much sex. Check it out. Now available on Amazon, paperback, and Kindle.
This is The Gala Show. I'm your reporter on the beat, Gala Avery. On this episode, you may know my guest as the writer of Small Soldiers, the director of films such as Never on Tuesday, Detroit Rock City, and the upcoming Last Train to Fortune, or maybe even as the head nerd in 16 Candles. But here on The Gala Show, I know him as that dude I met at Crossroads, Adam Rifkin.
That's me.
Hey, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Before we bring up the topic for today, I have a question for you. Where did the name Riff Coogan come from?
Well, that is a very good question. I suppose before I answer it, I should just give the people who don't know what Riff Coogan means just a bit of backstory. So when I was starting out, I wanted so badly to make my mark on cinema and make movies that were lasting and exciting, and movies that would inspire people the way movies that I grew up loving inspired me. But I also loved grindhouse movies, B movies, trash cinema, and I always thought it would be really fun to make those. And so I always felt that it would be neat to get an opportunity to do both kinds of movies. Where it all kind of solidified was I had made my very first film, which is called Never on Tuesday, which you just mentioned, when I was 20. I got very lucky. And after it was done, I reached out to a cinematic hero of mine who had made so many movies that inspired me when I was growing up, and that's the director John Landis. Animal House, Blues Brothers, American Werewolf in London, Trading Places, Coming to America.
The list goes on
and on. The list goes on and on.
All those classics.
Yeah, so he had an office on the Universal lot, I had heard. So I called Universal and I said, please connect me to the John Landis office. And his assistant answered, and I said that I'm a filmmaker. I made my first film. I'd love for John to see it. And she said, I'll tell him. I can't tell you what he'll say. So she called me back in 5 minutes. She said, okay, he'll screen the movie on Thursday. Bring the print at, you know, film print. You know, I had to carry the cans myself. Bring the print.
How many cans was it, like six?
It was two cans with six, with five reels in the cans, 20 minutes each. And she said, bring them to the Hitchcock screening room on the lot. You'll have a pass. And then afterwards, you guys can go to lunch at the commissary. And I couldn't believe it. How exciting. So I brought the film. He was super nice. Screened the movie. Very complimentary. Then we had lunch. And over lunch, he told me, when you're directing a movie, this was just like a throwaway part of the conversation, but it stuck with me. He said, when you're making a movie, you never get a chance to practice beforehand. You're thrown into an opportunity and you just have to rise to the occasion. You rarely get a chance to practice. So I was remembering that. So the first script I ever wrote and the movie that I had been trying to get made from the start was The Dark Backward, which I did ultimately make.
I actually just watched that last night.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it was so funny. I had another guest on the show, Zach Goody, who is the current lead singer of Smash Mouth. And I went to his house and he's like, I have two tapes for you. And one of them was The Dark Backward.
Wow.
And he had no clue that I was going to be talking with you.
Amazing.
And so he gave it to me as a gift.
That's nice.
And so I know. And I was like, well, it's kismet. I'm just going to watch it.
I guess I'm a Smash Mouth fan now.
I know.
That's great. Well, thank you for watching it. So anyway, I had wanted to make that movie from the start, but it was a harder movie to get funded, so we made Never on Tuesday first. Just kind of the planets just kind of aligned that way. But when The Dark Backward got funded, which mm-hmm. was a couple years later, I had some time before we were supposed to start shooting it, and I thought, God, I really want so badly to do the best job I can. I need practice. And I was thinking of John Landis's words, you know, you never get a chance to practice as a director. So at the time, another one of the producers of Never on Tuesday named Cassian Elwes. His father was Elliot Kastner. Elliot funded Never on Tuesday. And so Cassian and Brad Wyman produced Never on Tuesday. So then they also produced The Dark Backward. But before The Dark Backward was going, Cassian was cranking out lots of straight-to-video titles just as a side hustle, you know, just for money, because the home video market was booming at that time. And if a movie was 90 minutes long in color and had exploitable elements, it could make a fortune. So he was making lots of them. And I said, let me do one of these real quick before we do The Dark Backward, just so I get more
in
practice.
In the swing of things.
Yeah, I just wanted to get into the swing of things. So I made a movie called The Invisible Maniac, which recently came out on beautiful restored Blu-ray by Vinegar Syndrome.
I love Vinegar Syndrome.
I do too. So anyway, I needed a nom de plume for my exploitation persona, because I thought it would be fun to have...
straight to video.
Yeah, because I thought it would be fun to have like two parallel careers. Like Adam Rifkin making movies that hopefully, you know, make a difference, and this other persona that hopefully just cranks out tons of trash. Just, I thought it would be fun. So one of my favorite Clint Eastwood movies growing up was always Coogan's Bluff.
Mm-hmm.
And my nickname as a kid was Riff, because of my name Rifkin.
Yeah, Adam Rifkin.
So
yeah,
that's how I came up with the name Riff Coogan. And Riff Coogan wrote and directed The Invisible Maniac, Psycho Cop 2, and some other stuff.
I love it, because I actually have my own like pseudonym, like fake name. I use it on eBay. So
what,
people,
what is it?
I don't tell anyone.
Tell it.
I don't tell
it's
anyone.
A secret.
But it is like an amalgamation of kind of nicknames slash people that I love that I put together.
Makes sense.
I think a lot of people do that. Like Marilyn Manson, he got his name because of the two top Google searches, Marilyn Monroe and the Charles Manson.
Very clever.
Now, as always, my guest gets to bring their topic to the mic. Adam, why don't you tell us what your topic is and why you decided to choose it?
Okay, well, I've been racking my brain.
We had several different topics that we were...
yeah, for a long time about what my topic should be. And I was getting perhaps overly stressed out about this issue, because I wanted to bring an interesting topic. I went back and forth in my mind over a lot of different options. I think the topic that I'd like to discuss is... for aspiring filmmakers out there, I like to believe some of the people who are listening to this podcast are aspiring filmmakers, and I would like to talk about how they can get started shooting their movies sooner than later, if that's something they're wondering how to do. So my topic is make your movie. But first, time for a commercial break. And we're back.
You heard it here. The topic that we're going to be talking about today is make your movie. Come on, guys. Just get up and do it. 30 minutes on the clock and our time starts now.
Oh, the 30 minutes starts now.
Yeah, you're
none
30
of that
minutes.
Counts.
None of that counts. You got 30 minutes
good
now.
Good to know. Okay, good to know.
So you actually brought something with you today for me, which was your Adam Rifkin Film Festival.
I did. And this is ultimately what inspired the topic of the day. So I'm from Chicago. And when I was growing
up... from Chirac.
That's right. And when I was growing up, all I ever wanted to do was make movies. I loved them from as early an age as I can remember. And I just knew someday, somehow, some way, I wanted to move to Los Angeles and make movies as my grown-up job. I didn't understand at that time what a director was, what a producer was, that scripts were written. I didn't understand how any of that worked when I was 5 years old. I just knew that's where movies are made, in Hollywood, and I'm going there someday. But in the meantime, I decided I'm just going to make movies with my friends because it's fun. I didn't think about that I was teaching myself the principles of basic filmmaking, although I was, but I didn't understand that. I was just doing what I thought was fun to do with my friends, and then... someday I was going to move to Hollywood and learn how to do it for real.
Were you shooting on like Super 8? Or?
Super 8 film. That's right. I used my father's Sears Super 8 camera, home movie camera. And I just started making movies. So the first movie I made, I think I was about 6.
Wow.
And it's called The Lady Giant.
Is that included in this?
It is included in this.
Wow, your film from 6 years old is included.
Yes.
The Lady Giant.
Starring my sister, who was about 3 at the time.
The Lady Giant, I'm
yes,
assuming.
Yes, she's the Lady Giant. So, but the reason that I brought this disc to you is when we were doing the making of documentary about The Invisible Maniac for the Blu-ray release, one of the very talented filmmakers who creates supplemental material for Vinegar Syndrome titles is Elijah Drenner, who's also made some very great documentaries, like that guy Dick Miller's great documentary, and others. And so he was making this documentary about the making of The Invisible Maniac, and in discussing it, I was talking about making movies as a kid with my dad's movie camera. So when we were done, he said, "Do you still have those movies?" I said, "I do. Why?" He said, "Because we're starting a sister label that is going to be distributed through the Vinegar Syndrome machine. We're a sister label to Vinegar Syndrome, and we want to do a series of films, a series of releases of directors' childhood films."
Oh, I love that.
"And we want yours to be the first one." I said, "I'm delighted. I would love it." So I immediately went to my storage and found all the old Super 8 movies that I could from my childhood, and lots of them sadly didn't make it throughout the years, but enough did that we could fill this disc. And so he transferred them all, made beautiful transfers of them all, and put this incredible release together of all the childhood films that I made that could be found to this day. And he loaded it with extras and interviews with family and friends, and he put this incredible book together, and he hired Bob Fingerman to do the artwork.
The artwork is fantastic. That's the first thing I noticed when I saw this.
Yeah.
Especially because on the back, one of the things is Mad Magazine, and it was so reminiscent of Mad Magazine. I love it.
Well, Bob Fingerman, who did the artwork, used to do art for Mad Magazine.
Oh, well, then there you go.
Yeah. And he is also a famous illustrator and writer of comic books and graphic novels as well. But he sort of channeled the Jack Davis style.
The essence.
Yeah, for the cover, which is meant to look like a Mad Magazine kind of vibe. So anyway, this disc has all my childhood movies on it, starting with my very first one, The Lady Giant.
And you were six and shooting on Super 8.
Yeah.
And so is it, because I haven't seen it yet, obviously. So is it just like, did you edit it at 6 years old? Or is
I didn't
it just...
understand editing yet.
Yeah.
I did, for the first few years that I was making these movies, I did what was called at that time in-camera editing.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, unlike when you shoot something with your phone right now, where each clip that you shoot becomes its own separate
file.
Yeah. When you're shooting on Super 8, when you're rolling, it's filming. It's like a Super 8 camera is like a gun.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, and you point the lens and you hold the trigger down, which causes the film to go through the camera and captures the image. So you hold the trigger down while you're filming. And then when you stop, the film within the camera stops. And then when you resume filming, it resumes again.
Oh, so you really are doing in-camera editing.
So you are literally editing live in camera.
Wow.
So what we would do, because at a certain point, a lot of my friends got tired of making movies with me because that's all I wanted to do. But my friend Greg Anderson, he stuck around and he then was in the most movies of mine. So Greg would knock on the front door I'd film him knocking on the front door, you know, from inside.
Yeah.
Then I'd stop rolling. He'd change costume. He'd run over to the kitchen table and I'd film him there. And then he'd look up from his cereal and say, "Who is it?" And then I'd stop shooting. He'd change costume again, run to the front door. I'd film again at the front door. "It's me." You know, and so we did that the whole movie, all the movies that way for a long time. I eventually figured out, and you know, stating the obvious with a sense of discovery is how I sort of word this in my mind, right, when I think about it. It's like I discovered editing and it was like the sky opened up.
Well, because editing is really what filmmaking is.
Exactly.
Like you don't have editing in plays or in anything besides cinema.
Yeah, yeah. So I figured out, I can shoot the whole part of Greg in the sandbox at once, and then I can shoot the whole part of Greg peeking around the corner and sneaking over to the sandbox and stabbing the guy in the sandbox in another take. And then later I could edit them together on this little hand crank, little Super 8 editing.
Is it like a moviola? No, moviola is where they goes.
Like, it's the same vibe as a moviola, but you hand cranked it to watch it. And then you'd stop and you'd cut the film with a little scissors or like a little pill cutter thing, you know, and then you tape it together or glue it together. And I figured out editing and I taught myself how to do that. And I was very pleased with myself. But anyway, I digress. So The first movie was The Lady Giant, starred my sister. And I remember it was starting to get cold. We were living in outside of Chicago in an area called Arlington Heights at that time. And my mother and I had built a little city out of an Erector set, and I had Matchbox cars, and she was supposed to stomp in and crush the city. That was
it's like
the,
Godzilla.
Yeah, it was the whole movie, basically. So my mother insisted that my sister wear her winter coat because it was getting cold. And I got so upset because we got into a huge fight because, of course, obviously, everybody knows giants don't wear coats. So she was insistent. And
even when they're cold?
It's true. Giants don't get cold. So I lost that battle. And I when I think about it, that's kind of like the first battle I lost with the studio.
Yeah, with your producer.
Yeah, exactly. So the giant, that was my first compromise.
It was your first Hollywood lesson.
That's right. The film is about compromise. Anyway, so then I just spent my whole youth making movies with my friends and my sister, and until eventually I moved out to Los Angeles to pursue it for real.
So do these are basically all of your Chicago films?
These are all of my Chicago films, and there's one film at the end that I made out here. So when I got an opportunity to direct my first film, as I was mentioning, Brad Wyman and Cassian Ellis were working for Elliot Kastner at the time. Mm-hmm. Elliot produced many, many classic films. Clint Eastwood films, Marlon Brando films, Richard Burton films, Paul Newman films.
Burt Reynolds films? No?
I don't think he ever produced a Burt Reynolds film.
I only bring that up because we were talking about Burt Reynolds
earlier.
Of course,
you know I love Burt Reynolds. I don't think he produced any Burt Reynolds. Oh, yes, he produced Heat. Of course, what am I talking about? He produced Heat, not, of course, the Michael Mann.
Yeah, yeah.
He produced Heat, which was originally going to be directed by Robert Altman, and then Elliot fired Robert Altman. And then the movie became a debacle, and Burt punched out the director. And
wow.
It was a huge, huge mess. But yes, Elliot did produce that Burt Reynolds film. and Burt was not too happy about when he would talk about that experience. He was not too happy about Elliot Kastner. There's a joke about that in the movie The Player.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, so...
God, that movie, I watched that movie with my film club, and I couldn't watch it because I was so uncomfortable because it felt like everyone I knew.
Of course, that's exactly right.
That's so L.A.
So it's so L.A. So in the movie, the Larry Levy character, who's the up-and-coming studio exec who's threatening the potential career of the lead played by...
The Player. I can't remember his
Why
name.
Am I blanking on his name, too?
I don't know.
Bob Roberts. What's his name? Why am I blanking on his name? I don't know.
That's the thing. Also, we don't have cell phones in here to check. We don't ever do it. It's all of our brain. But it's going to come to us at lunch. It's like, it's him.
Tim Robbins. What am I talking about?
There we
go. Tim Robbins, okay? So anyway, Larry Levy is walking through a restaurant, and he sees Burt Reynolds having lunch. And he says, Mr. Reynolds, I hope you don't remember me. And if you do, I hope there are no hard feelings. I was only working for Kastner at the time. And that was an inside joke between Burt Reynolds and Robert Altman about Elliot because of the experience. But anyway.
You came to L.A.
I came to L.A. Oh, that's, by the way, when I went to USC briefly, I only went for a short time. That's where I met Larry Karaszewski.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He and Scott Alexander were students there when I was a student there.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway.
But you were only there for a brief time.
I was only there for a year. Yeah. But they were seniors when I was a freshman.
Yeah.
Where was I?
You came to L.A. The one L.A. movie.
So Elliot, so I met Brad and Cassian, and they wanted to make a movie with me, and I wanted to make a movie with them, and we were trying to convince Elliot to fund it, and he wouldn't fund The Dark Backward, because The Dark Backward is too weird for him.
It was definitely weird.
He didn't like that. He said he would fund a movie for me to direct on two conditions. Do I have a script that would appeal to the kids, meaning teens? And would I direct a short film to prove to him that I can make a movie? I said yes to both. I said I'll shoot anything, of course. And I have a script that's perfect that would appeal to the kids. I actually didn't. But
that's the beauty of filmmaking, though. Like that's what my dad did with Killing Zoe. they're like, do you have a movie like a, that could be shot in a bank? And he's like, yes. And then he hung up the phone and wrote the script.
That's
and there you go.
Exactly. That's what you got to do. That's an opportunity that you got to grab for. So I ran home. He said, bring in the script tomorrow. I said, I let me just tweak it a little bit and I'll polish it up a little bit.
The old tweak. Like, let me just give it a polish.
I'll bring it in on Monday. This was like on a Wednesday. I ran home and I wrote it in the next however many days and brought it in. And he didn't even read it. He just said to Cassian and Brad, will the kids like it? Yo, they'll love it. Okay, you can make it. And so I got to make my first film. But because, you know, part of the deal was I had to direct a short to prove that I could direct, he gave me a few $1,000 and Brad and Cassian produced this short film that is included on this disc as well.
Have you ever drawn from these kind of short films that you made growing up and also the one from Los Angeles in your future material? Like, do you have repeating themes that you developed kind of as
yes,
a child?
I would say so. I mean, I have a lot of my influences are clear as day in these films, mm-hmm. even on the cover. I mean, Mad Magazine, Monty Python.
Yep, the other one, Mel Brooks, Mel Blanc.
Of course, exactly. The Warner Brothers cartoons.
Cornucopia of cartoonish capers.
Yeah, all these things, you know, influenced, and of course a lifelong love of movies, influenced what kinds of movies I thought would be fun to make and because they were the kinds of movies that I thought were fun to see.
What kind of movies were fun for you to see, like when you were at like that 6 to through 18, I'm guessing?
Well, my first love were monster movies, and that started a little bit before the Lady Giant era, when my grandfather bought me, it was like a 1-2-3 punch sort of moment that kind of just solidified this love of monster movies to me. He bought me a Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, which is a popular magazine at the time about monster movie making. He bought me a Dracula model kit, which I built, which was fun. And I saw the movie Dracula, which happened to be playing like very, you know, in a day or two after that on Svengoolie, which was the Chicago local horror show host show. And so
Svengoolie.
So for those who don't know, in the olden days, local television was huge before everything was, you know, nationalized. All the local affiliates had their local programming that they would produce locally. I mean, there's still local news that's produced and a few local like magazine kind of shows.
Like barely anymore, yeah. Though. Because also people are not watching television. I had someone come in and they told me a statistic on wrestling where it was like rated like a 7 and now Survivor is rated a 1.
Yeah.
And people are watching Survivor.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know what's happened. Exactly. Streaming, I guess.
So in those days, all the local markets produced their own programming as well as airing national programming like The Tonight Show, mm-hmm. and you know, Famous, you know, All in the Family or whatever. But so Chicago's version, so LA had like Vampira at first, and then they mm-hmm. had Elvira. New York had Zachary. Boston had one, I remember, called Simon Sanctorum. So Chicago had Svengoolie.
I think that's the best name out of all of them, to be honest.
Simon Sanctorum? Yes.
No, Svengoolie.
Oh, Svengoolie is the best. Yeah, Svengoolie. So Svengoolie showed all the Universal monster movies, all the Hammer horror films from the UK, all the Japanese giant monster movies.
Wow, so you really got like the full spectrum of monster movies.
Yeah, all the AIP drive-in movies.
Wow, you really were lucky.
Svengoolie was my first film school, right?
Wow.
I was exposed to all those films. And so that was my first love of movies. But then the movie that opened my mind to film as an art form, film as a medium with which to expand one's mind, that you can you can see the world differently after seeing a particular film, that just could completely inspire you emotionally, artistically, was when I saw, I guess I was probably about 12, and I saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie suddenly made me realize I love film, not just
movies
a particular genre of film. I love movies. And so that became then my goal, is just to see as many different kinds of movies as possible and just drink it all in. And Chicago at that time had a number of really good revival houses. So I would see movies at the Parkway.
So like 12 years old, you're going to the revival houses.
All the time.
That's amazing. That's just awesome.
It was great. And Chicago had the Parkway and the Varsity and the Music Box and several others. And they would play a different double feature every day. It's a different double feature. And they'd have these big calendars, very much like the New Beverly today.
It's like the New Beverly. Yes. I was going to say, thank God for the Bev, because it gives people like me a taste of what I didn't have.
Absolutely. And LA has a lot of options. And thanks to Quentin, the Vista is going to be another one, which is fantastic. But the thing about these revival houses is they catered to real movie lovers. So one day they would show an Ingmar Bergman double feature, and the next day they'd show a Herschel Gordon Lewis double feature.
Yeah, it's exactly like the Bev. It's like if you go on Monday, you're getting Grindhouse, you're getting like old black and white noir, or you're getting Westerns. Like that's my favorite night to go is Mondays.
I love that. And so the people who really love movies understand that you love all kinds of movies, you know? And there are, of course, snobby film people who only like the arty stuff, and there are genre fans who only like the trashy
stuff.
Only
like horror, only like whatever.
Which is, hey, more power to them, whatever they like. But if someone's a true fan of film, they like it all, you know? And so my film education growing up was very broad. And then, as I got a little older, home video became a thing. And so then you could see so many more movies.
And also you could see, I remember Eli telling me that you could then see like all the Italian films, and you could all then see all like the Chinese Hong Kong movies, and you wouldn't know what it was because they were under the wrong names, or like you'd have to figure it out, like do detective work. Do you think it's easier for youth now to pick up a camera and make a movie than it was for you back then?
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about today. And I know I took a long route to get to your question just now. But here's the thing. Today, unlike when I was growing up, the idea of shooting a movie on a Super 8 camera and it somehow being commercially released was absurd. It was not in the realm of reality, right? But now, what has been proven time and time again is that the medium, if you're starting out, it doesn't matter. What matters is what you have to say and how cleverly you say it. So now you can shoot a movie with your phone. And many filmmakers have proven.
Well, like Sean Baker.
Sean Baker. I mean, I love Tangerine.
I think Tangerine is one of the best LA movies ever made.
Without question, right? And I think that movie proves, and so many others now, that if you really want to make a movie, stop sitting around waiting for somebody to give you $1 million or $10 million.
Or even $50,000.
Or even $50,000, right. If you have $100 in your pocket, make a movie for $100. I take inspiration from my friend and the subject of a documentary I made named Giuseppe Andrews. Do you know who Giuseppe
Andrews
is?
No, I don't. Tell me.
So Giuseppe Andrews was a child actor. He starred in a movie I made called Detroit Rock City. But when we were making the movie, he told me he loves film. He loves foreign film. He loves Fassbender. He loves Pasolini. He loves Fellini. He loves all these films, and he wants to make film. And I was very encouraging. You got to do it. Just shoot movies. Shoot movies. So he bought a camcorder, and he just started making movies. He lived in a trailer park with his dad, and he started making movies starring all of the homeless people living around the trailer park.
It's like Sean Baker going on Craigslist and like getting all the actors.
Right. And he's made hundreds of them now. And so I made a documentary about him making one of them called Giuseppe Makes a Movie, which is now, the movie came out probably in 2014.
So about 10 years ago.
About 10 years ago, yeah. So anyway, Giuseppe's philosophy is, if I have $50 in my pocket, I'm making a $50 movie. If I have $1,000 in my pocket, I'm making a $1,000 movie. And he just makes movie after movie after movie. And what makes his movies, they're the craziest, most bonkers movies you've ever seen. But I take great inspiration from his just do-it-yourself spirit. Like, he's just going to make movies because he feels he has no other choice. He has to.
He has to actually exercise the passion that's within him and do it. I think that's a really important thing because we have more access now than ever. Like, my age group and below has more access than ever for cameras. Correct. We literally carry one in our pocket every single day. Exactly. But like, are we out there making movies, or are we, like, as you said, like waiting for someone to bring it to us? Like, where has our drive gone?
Exactly. So when I was growing up, if somebody told me that I could make a movie now, I could just start shooting it today, and it could be released to a worldwide audience and be seen by people around the globe, and I could
without you having to pay for a release.
Yeah. I mean, you could shoot a movie right now on your phone. You could put it on YouTube. You can promote it on social media, and you could be getting fan mail on, you know, social media from Japan, from
or India.
India. From people can be seeing it from anywhere.
South Africa.
Yeah, around the world.
Anywhere.
And so my, if somebody's out there listening and they are hungry to make movies, my advice to them, my unsolicited advice, and for whatever it's worth, if you've got a cell phone and you've got the ability to download an editing app or editing software, and you've got some friends who, you know, everybody's got that friend who's willing to do anything.
Yeah, they just need like a French fries or something.
Exactly. Take it seriously. Make the best movie you can for whatever amount of money you have. And by the way, if you've got $50 in your pocket and you've got a goofy friend who lives down the road who will eat, you know, live bugs or whatever, don't try to make a Civil War epic.
A question. Like when you, some people, like they might really be like, I only like horror movies. Uh-huh. And I only watch horror movies.
Right.
But I don't have the materials to make a horror movie. But maybe they have access to make, I don't know, a rom-com or a comedy.
Okay, but let's take that exact example. So, okay, Oren Peli, who I know, made Paranormal Activity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in his house. Okay,
for freaky movie.
For $5,000, right? The whole crew was him, okay? The whole cast were just a few people. The biggest expense, the biggest line item in his budget was he had the carpets taken out of his house and hardwood floors put in because he thought that would be better for the movie. That was the most expensive aspect of the movie. And that movie, because it was good, because it was creepy and scary, it got, and you know, when it first got accepted into Slam Dance,
mm-hmm.
it was not polished. It was not, it was just made by him, edited by him,
handmade.
In his house, handmade, and it freaked everybody out who saw it. Suddenly everybody was talking about it. So I obtained a bootleg VHS of it from somebody who knew him. This was before I met him. And I watched it. I was just scared the crap out of me. You know what I mean? And so, and then suddenly that created a whole industry, obviously. And by the way, he's not the first one that did it. They did it with the Blair Witch Project before.
Yeah,
that.
I was talking with someone also about how Blair Witch Project, it was so amazing because people, when it first came out, thought it was real.
Yes, exactly.
And now it's like, I haven't seen that yet. But part of the reason why I haven't seen it is because I know the whole history behind the movie. So sure. Would it be as effective for me as an audience
it's
in
still,
this moment?
I still love it.
I can't wait. I have to see it with an audience. I think like a midnight show at the Bev.
Yeah, I knew it wasn't real when I saw it, but I still loved it. And I love Paranormal Activity. And I just love that can-do mentality of just like, all right, we've got access to my dad's car dealership. We've got $500 and we've got
this chick wants to be in it.
Yes, exactly. And just make a movie that's set around the car dealership and star your friends and, you know, and don't cast your 17-year-old friend as the president of the United States. You know what I mean? Make it so that it, you know, make a movie that utilizes your whatever restrictions you are working within. Utilize those to your advantage creatively. Make everything look like it was a creative choice, you know? So if you've got a bunch of slacker friends who like to sit around smoking pot, you could make a really effective movie about a bunch of slacker friends sitting around smoking pot, you know? And then they come upon some mystery and they got to solve a crime and they, you know, whatever the story is, I keep hitting the microphone.
Okay.
Do you hear it?
No, it's okay.
So
whatever story it is. Do you also think that it's, I don't know, sometimes people also get like nervous about making a movie. Like just start with a short. Just start with like 1 minute even.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that too. I mean, just get nimble. Practice, as John Landis told me to do. Get some practice. So if you want to make a few shorts just to sort of get into the swing of it, feel how it feels to get behind the camera and shoot your coverage and cut it together and see how it feels and how it plays and show it to people and get some feedback, people that you trust. And little by little, as you build up your confidence, just make your movie. You know what I mean? And by the way, there are labs today that will develop Super 8 film.
Yes. And I think people should be shooting on Super 8 personally.
They should.
I think it gives it a more expensive feel sometimes than just digital.
Well, because it's film.
Yeah. Exactly. Even shooting on video.
Yeah.
I know there are several filmmakers that shoot on video in Los Angeles and they're actually teaming up with VHS companies to release their movies on VHS, which I think is really awesome.
I think it's awesome. And I think it's great that the public at large has been, thanks to the success of certain films like Paranormal Activity and others, have been acclimated now to movies being presented to them in a variety of formats that it might have been shot differently than a standard studio film. So as a result, if somebody makes a really good movie shot on Super 8 today, they will accept it. They will watch it. They will go to see it, or they will buy it or whatever. If it's good, it doesn't matter how it was shot. It just matters that it's good. So make your movie. Just what are you waiting for? Stop waiting for permission. Stop waiting for millions of dollars. Just make your movie now. That's my advice.
Right now. Stop listening to this podcast and go make your movie.
That's right.
Honestly, I think also when something has a handmade quality, it lends itself really well to horror. Or just that, because
sure.
I think we're so used to CGI, like with all the Marvel movies, and our brains have kind of just like become numb to it, that when you see something that's actually handmade, it's really scary.
It's very scary because it feels real. That's why movies like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, are so effective, because it feels real. It feels like a documentary. So that still applies. And that's why Paranormal Activity was so good. And that's why...
Evil Dead also.
Evil it's Dead's like a all, great, like, great example.
I think one. I just saw this movie, When Evil Lurks, and it has a bunch of practical effects. It just came out. Was at Beyond Fest. Oh my God, that movie was scary. I came
Excellent,
home.
Good.
I came home and I locked my door and I was like, I turned on all my lights. I checked like my rooms. So I'm like, okay, no one's in here. And I'm still thinking about it days later. And it's partially because of the practical effects.
Of course, it makes perfect sense. I mean, we know from seeing it in so many movies, the look of digital effects. And sometimes they're fabulous, obviously, and sometimes they're not.
Well, sometimes it's warranted and sometimes it's not.
Exactly. But they're just a tool, right? As is everything else. So just because the one tool is in vogue doesn't mean that that's the only tool to be used. So if you can get some fun bang for some out of your buck by doing some practical effects, and your movie lends itself in that direction, and you don't have any money, but because you're doing things the old-fashioned way, it feels more real and feels more creepy, more power to you. Go for it. I'm sure you've heard of this movie, Skinamarink.
Yes.
So that movie was made for nothing, also in the guy's house, you know? And it was, I mean, listen, some people love it, some people hate it. I happen to have found it to be very creepy, right? That movie was made for nothing, absolutely nothing. But because it was effective, it got a real release. It got a theatrical release.
And a lot of buzz.
And a lot of buzz.
What would you say for people that don't have any friends to make movies with?
Figure out a way to make it with your cat or with your dog. Or
there's your monster right there.
Right. Or like Sean Baker did, go on Craigslist and cast your movie with, you know, everywhere you are, there is a local theater scene. There is a local film office that has access to or information about, oh my God.
Oh my God, you just hit your 30 minutes. That's all the time that we have for today. But Adam, is there any final thought that you'd like to leave the audience with?
Yes, this is a message for any aspiring filmmaker out there. You can't fail in your pursuit. You can certainly quit, but you can't fail because there's no end to the number of opportunities you can create for yourself.
I love that. Thank you, Adam, for coming on the show. If you'd like to keep up with Adam, you can check him out on X, also known by me and my dad affectionately as Roman numeral 10, at his handle, Adam Rifkin. Or check out his Instagram at Adam_Rifkin. P.S. Be on the lookout for Last Train to Fortune, because I personally can't wait to see that in theaters.
I can't wait for you to see it.
I'm Gala Avery, and this has been The Gala Show. The Gala Show is brought to you by Insert-O-Matic. This episode was executive produced by Roger Avery and produced by Gala Avery. Music composed by Andy Milburn. As always, I'm your host, Gala Avery. Copyright 2023, all rights reserved. Despite me sharing the same last name with this charity, I don't have any affiliation with it, besides the fact the issue is very near and dear to my heart. Did you know that in the United States, 2.7 million children currently have a parent in prison, and it's estimated that 10 million children have experienced parental incarceration at some point in their lives? I was one of these kids, and as an adult, I am really grateful to be able to give back to Project Avery. Their mission is to build leadership from within by supporting community through programs such as mentoring and outdoor education, and also to remove the stigma surrounding having a parent that's incarcerated. You don't have to feel alone. If you know a kid who could use these resources or would like to donate money or time to the charity, please go to Project Avery, that's AVARY.org, to check out what this amazing charity is all about. Again, that's ProjectAvery.org. Thank you guys from the bottom of my heart.